and we have to reverse it through education. Andrew, I want to go back to you. We're going to be taking some calls here in just a moment, and we're going to be discussing maybe more elements from your book. What other important elements to the South African story did you treat in the Synagogue of Satan, the book you wrote?
Well, I think it was primarily the aspects of the Boer War and the diamond mining interests. Oppenheim was estimated to control 95% of the diamond trade worldwide. And there was also rumours that diamonds are a lot more. There are a lot more diamonds about than is actually said, and the idea is that the same with oil. If you control, have one group controlling it all and telling everybody how scarce it is, then they can charge higher prices. If you can tap the whole market and have a monopoly. The other thing that we need to say about the Boer War is that was where the concentration camp was invented. And they were putting these farmers into camps that they built, and they were dying in these camps because they weren't sanitary. They were just packing them into them, and that was where it was created. And concentration camp means a concentration of people.
Which is a perfect host for typhoid and cholera and dysentery, and then they didn't provide these people with any resources that would ameliorate these diseases. So, of course, tens and tens of thousands of them died in these camps.
Well, absolutely. And, the other thing, as I say, with South Africa, I mean, what we were discussing earlier, if you look at recently, I think we had Zimbabweans going to South Africa and taking work, and there was strife breaking out between the native South African population and the Zimbabweans, because they felt that they were taking their work and people were killed over it and what have you. So that's it goes to show it's not something that happens between different races of different colour. It can happen with different groups. And if you look at Zimbabwe, what they've done there is a cleverly engineered attempt in returning these white-owned farms when Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa. If they'd have done it in a sense of a fair purchase of the land, and then people of the local community were trained how to run it and they ran it, instead they said, no, if you see a white farm, you have every right to go in and just kill the occupants and take what you want. And so what they were doing was...
What I'd like to bring up is that the fact that South Africa stood by, the government of South Africa stood by, knowing what was being done, knowing full well that they could stop it at any time they wished, by not just by political pressure, but any means that they needed, they could have stopped it. And in fact, the world supported Mugabe's actions in that area, and they've watched a country go from one of the wealthiest and best organized countries in Africa into a complete cesspit of anarchy and starvation and disease and problems and runaway inflation, and it's all been by design. And what's going to end up coming now is, it seems to me, that a lot of the investment capital that went into South African mines is now going to migrate into the Zimbabwe region, and they're going to start pulling out minerals out of the ground there with a workforce that is starving. So, of course, they'll go into any situation for peanuts, and they'll work for just about anything. And it was a designed deal, and it looks like the powers that be in Britain are the ones that put this thing together.
Well, I agree, and there's some... I've been trying to find it on the internet, but there was footage from a few years ago in which Jack Straw, who was the Home Secretary then, Zionist, Jewish, from the UK, he's filmed going up to Robert Mugabe, running up to him, smiling, laughing, and shaking his hand. And then this was filmed, and it was put out in the media for some reason. So obviously, they were firing a warning shot at Jack Straw, and Jack Straw came out and said, oh, he didn't recognize him. He thought he was someone else. I mean, that was the excuse they were given. So basically, he was just shaking his hand saying, oh, the plan's going really well. I mean, with what they're doing with these farms, of course, we've got to reiterate the term of Zimbabwe was breadbasket of Africa. But instead of people going onto these farms and working these farms, they dug up all the drainage and the irrigation to sell the pipes off for scrap and get an easy buck straight away rather than do the hard work and continue the breadbasket of Africa theme. As a result now,
the government thugs that were going out into the countryside doing this were not permitting these farms to reopen. In fact, their policy was not to reopen them, but rather create a panic amongst the people who actually got their sustenance from these farms. And these people, once these farms are destroyed, those people that got their, made their living working and providing a service to that farmer starved. They started going hungry. And now what we've got is mass problems in that nation, but you don't need to look any further than going north into the Congo region and seeing similar kinds of horrors being orchestrated. Now, this is a policy decision. You can see it when you go to Darfur, and you know that the Jean Jouy's weaponry and murder machine is coming out of Israel. So the fact is this stuff is going on across Pan-Africa, and yet when we discuss it in mainstream news, it's the dictator that gets blamed. But you and I both know that Donald Rumsfeld, that cretin, criminal Zionist, was shaking Saddam's hand back in the 1980s. They were best buddies. And we sold Iraq the chemical weapons, the chemicals they used in the northern region to suppress an uprising. So, but then we turn around and blame them for using the weapons we sold them. This hypocrisy and lies and criminality goes unnoticed because people don't, the press we rely on to tell us these facts never, ever tells us the truth.
And that's why it's so important for this group to have control of the press. That was the second thing they wanted control of. They got control of the government, they got control of the banking first, therefore the governments, and then the next thing that they needed was the press. Because the free press, with a free press, then the press can go out and they can report on what's really going on, and they'll never get away with all this. But they now think that they've won, and they've got the whole thing in the bag. And it's increasingly looking like they have. Because people, if people read the press now, there's hardly any news in it. It's just celebrity gossip or sport. And that's what people live on. And it's, reality shows for the women and football matches for the men. And that's supposed to be what our life is about now. And then, you go to work during the week.
Well, that's exactly what they reduced us to. And family gatherings are starting to fall away. People, they're working more, have less time to build good relationships with the generations in their homes. You know, Andrew, when I was a kid, the grandparents didn't go to a nursing home and lay there to rot. The family took care of the elderly and the children in the same family, and we had communication between the generations, and there was information being shared and experiences being shared between those generations. What we've got today is a mechanized world of substandard education, substandard entertainment, substandard healthcare, substandard everything by design. And when we complain about it, they tell us that the solutions are the problems are our fault, not theirs. And when you look at who designed these things, it always goes back to this very same group. Their fingerprints and their names and their associations are all over it. What do you say to that?
Well, I totally agree with you, Darrell. And, the latest thing that they're doing is in Britain, our postal service, Royal Mail, they're coming out and they've said that they need to sell at least 30% of it off to get more money in to private investors, and we all know who those private investors are going to be. And it's just the next rung on the ladder. Initially it was the banks, then the media, and then it was all the public companies like electricity, and then Then they want the water supply, and then the next thing they wanted was they wanted all the local government council contracts for garbage and all these different things. And so in the end, you're being run by these private groups, and they're subcontracting out to public services. And in the end, you'll have the whole public services will all be run by these private groups for profit, which will put the quality down and the cost up, so these people can have a few extra billion. And that's what it's all about. You just need to look, you need to look where you live today and look at it 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, certainly in this country, it was far better. There was more maintenance of the roads. There was more cleaning of the streets. These days, you don't get that. And you live in an absolute tip. I mean, there are roads that I drive down with big potholes in that you can get. You have to be so careful driving down the road because they haven't got the money to repair them, for the simple reason that whereas before they'd have their own people working for them, this time what they're doing now is that it's all subcontracted out. And even though they've doubled in 10 years the council tax you pay in this country, the services have gone down because everyone that they're employing now has a profit margin on them, whereas before there was no profit margin required.
Well, you know, Andrew, I'm going to open up the phone lines. It's after the top of the hour, and if anybody wants to share their ideas and thoughts about what we're discussing today, they can call us from within South Africa. It's 011-4947-007, or outside of South Africa, it's 0027-1149-47007. Call with your questions for Andrew, or maybe a comment that we can expand upon here, because there are a lot of things that we need to discuss here, ladies and gentlemen. The battle is on. You know, Andrew, we've talked so many times privately, both here at my home where when you visited and on the phone conversations we've had. We have done a great service to mankind by informing them of this, of these facts, because frankly, 4 or 5 years ago when I started this radio show, it was not well known in the world that these people were doing this. And, of course, with help of people like you and others, that is no longer true. I would venture to say that there are millions today that know these facts, and even tens of millions. Tonight's broadcast alone is speaking to an audience of a million or so. So the fact is, we know that this message is growing in importance. What is it that we need to do here in order to put the stop to this? Because, you know, nobody complained where I live when Veolia took over my water. Nobody complained in the city next to me when they took over the rubbish pickup. Nobody complained in Australia when they took over the power plant running and the septic system running in Australia. Same company, Veolia. When they took over the bus service in Sweden, nobody complained. Now, this is Rothschild-owned business. And my point is that they are systematically buying up the world's services, and we are going to have no services unless we go through these criminals. They'll own all the major companies and all the major services and all the major governments, and we won't have a darn thing to stand up on. We've got a call coming in from Aisha. Aisha, are you with me?
Yes, hello. How are you doing?
Very well, Aisha. Do you have a question or a comment for us?
I'd like to make a comment of what I've just realized and I've heard on the call. On your show today, that, you know, there's an extreme fear from the colonialists, especially, of Islam. I don't know why they are afraid, because, you know, we, the Muslims, did not go out to the world and force people to become Muslims. We didn't go and build our church, our mosques everywhere, and force the community of that country to become Muslims. Whereas, you know, the Christians have come everywhere, build a mosque, change the religion of every community that they've come into to force them to become Christians. Why is it extreme fear of Islam, I'd like to know? And I've gathered that
let me try
to cover up for him. I'd like to know why are we afraid of Islam?
Aisha, let me address this, will you please? The fact is that the people in charge of the religious organizations of our world, and that is, you can look no further than Pat Robertson and the guy Falwell, and I mean, this guy Hagee and so many others, and including the Pope. the man who is supposed to be leading the Christian church and the Catholic Church of Rome, when he knows darn well that certain facts are real, he stands behind the lie. When Zionism or not to follow a Zionist rule or not Zionist rule, Pat Robertson automatically goes by the Zionist-controlled group. My point is that we have been victimized by bad leadership in religion, and see, people who are of good character and of good morals rarely have a disagreement, even when they're not from the same religion. When we have religions that have been co-opted by crime and by moral crime, by money crime, by crimes of every sort, what we end up with is a situation where there's distrust, there is intolerance, there are problems. You know, Andrew, I want you to address this. You know, the British government are the people who opened up Britain to the immigration from Pakistan and India. And now that was a wonderful thing for the Indians and Pakistanis who came there to have a job. But I believe, and I have looked into this issue, there were more sinister reasons involved, because the same kinds of things were being done in every other Western country to build a minority in a society, keep them poor, keep them poorly educated, don't give them opportunity, and then inflame their community so that hatred could be spewed against the two groups. This is what happened by design. And I've seen this by design happening. See, you think it's about the religions themselves. It's not. It's the leadership of these religions that are actually pitting us against each other.
Well, I can answer Aisha's point. Hello, Aisha. The situation is, and the reason I raise this point, is I don't think that there has been any benefit from bringing immigration over from Pakistan and India to Britain, to India or Pakistan. If the British government wanted to help those people, then they would have provided aid to that country in order to get it up to a level of infrastructure and what have you that was in Britain at the time that they brought these people over. But by bringing people over a completely new culture to a country that's had the same culture for hundreds of years, it has created divisions. And so people...
But I think it's by design.
No, I agree. That's the reason that they did it. But I never made any criticism of Islam or said that the Muslims over in Britain are over here trying to make everybody else be Muslims. I've not said that at all. What I'm saying is I don't think it would be right for white Christian societies to go over, if the situation was in reverse, for white Christian societies to go over to India and Pakistan and start building Church of England churches
Wait a minute, Andrew. This is the point she was making. The Christians did go proselytizing Africans. They did bring their missionaries.
Yeah.
They did bring their churches. They did force them into... They did it to the Hawaiians in the Hawaiian Islands. They did it to, this idea that Christianity would go out and proselytize the world and force it to believe the things they did has been in force for hundreds of years. So that is something that is part of the history of Christianity. The point I'm saying here is at this late hour, in this time that we're in now, the reasons why they have brought these minorities into Western Europe is to create hatred against Islam so that Christians in the European community, when a fight starts between in Islam, we're going to say, see, that they're not nice people, they need to be destroyed. They've used this as a way of turning people against each other. What we need to do is reverse that trend. We have to reverse that trend.
Well, I agree with you, Daryl, and we only need to look at the fact that the 9/11 and the London bombings and Madrid were all blamed on Islam. Whichever way they want to say it in the media, they still blame Islam. And so that encourages the man on the street to have skepticism and feel uncomfortable with these other communities in their country when they weren't responsible for it at all. We know it was the Zionist group. On your point about Christians going into Africa and trying to convert people to Christianity, I don't agree with that either. That's precisely my point. I think that nations, we have to go all the way back to the Crusades when we were having wars with, you know, Muslims against Christians and what have you. And these different societies just existed, and they were in the previous few hundred years to the last century were pretty much existing okay together, and they had their own communities. But what they've done is that they've mixed up communities, and rather than addressing problems between faiths, so the media will turn around and say, oh yeah, this, there's a line here in the Quran, and it's hateful to people who won't convert to Islam, or and they'll push all those sort of ideals, and they won't actually
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the Zionist press again doing the hatred. And see, isn't it interesting that they could spin hatred against Islam whenever they feel like it and get nobody to say that's not what we want to be doing here. But if you try to do that about the Talmudic Judaism, if you start talking about the Talmud, they call you an anti-Semite and they try to get you arrested.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's double standards all the time, and this is what we're talking about, and this is why the show, I'm trying to sort of gear what I'm saying to the Islamic audience, and I'm not going to go for an easy way out. I believe that these have been created by design to create further division between these two groups, and we only need to look at the Albert Pike blueprint for the three world wars, that the third one
was going to be between
Christianity and Islam. And so the reason that we're doing this is
100 years ago.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about Albert Pike and what he said, because these people designed this fight between Islam and Christianity 100 years ago. They knew this was coming. They designed it.
Well, Albert
Pike said, will you?
Yeah, he was a high-level Freemason. And basically, he came up with a blueprint for three world wars. And the world wars that we've had followed that blueprint. The first one was to be... The first world war was to be fought for the purpose of destroying the Tsar in Russia, which Nathan Rothschild promised in 1815, and replace that with communism. And communism is used to attack religions. So communism is the enemy of Islam, it's the enemy of Christianity, it's the enemy of Hinduism, Buddhism, whatever you want to call it. And the differences between the British and German empires were used to foment the war. The Second World War was to be used to foment the controversy between fascism and political Zionism. This was to be by the oppression of Jews in Germany, which, as we know, was also designed to create the State of Israel, and a state can't exist without a people, so if you put the people in fear, then they'll leave whatever country they feel in fear of and go to a safe haven, which was supposed to be Israel. Third World War, which is the one that we have coming up, I believe, is played out by stirring up hatred of the Muslim world for what they're doing with all these terrorist attacks and saying it's Islam. That's stirring up hatred of the Muslim world for the purposes of playing the Islamic world and the political Zionists off against one another. Whilst this is going on, the remaining nations will be forced to fight themselves into a state of mental, physical, spiritual, and economic exhaustion. And then subsequent to that is when you're going to get your one world government, your one world religion. And so essentially what the Zionists are up to is that they want to break down all existing nations and nations, religions, communities in order to bring in a one world government that they control, and then a one world religion which will be everybody respects each other, everyone can do what they want to do, no morals whatsoever. You'll probably find that Christianity and Islam will both be outlawed, and that's what they're aiming for, and that's why it's important for us now to recognise that the different communities existing in countries, we have to admit that there are tensions between those communities. Only by admitting that there are tensions between the communities. Can the communities say, what are those tensions? Let's sort this out. And then they'll find out who the real enemy is, so they can work together to defeat the real enemy. Because at the moment, the real enemy is creating the tensions. The people in each community are falling for it and being sceptical of one another. And they're not recognising who the true enemy is.
That's right. And you remember years ago, Andrew, this terrorist named Abu Nidal?
Oh, yeah.
You remember? Well, Abu Nidal was the guy that was blamed for the Munich attack on the Israeli athletes, and he also was the attacker of the Achille Lauro and all this. Well, it's come out subsequent to that in documentation, both on the net and other places, that Abu Nidal was actually an operative working for the secret Mossad group. So basically, he was a Mossad-paid agent, and what he was doing was he was there representing Islam, but he was not from Islam. He was a false flag terrorist developed by Israel to create hatred against Islam. And this was the very beginning of this stuff that has been going on for the last 30, 40 years, where they are fomenting anger between Algerian Muslims in France and the Pakistani Muslims in Britain and Turkish Muslims in Germany. And what they're trying to do is piggyback these hatreds that they've built up over time into saying, look, we can't trust each other, we're going to have to fight it out, and we're going to destroy each other, and it has worked. But what if we can tell people what they've done and how they did it and why they did it, and we can come together and start working together to stop them, this is the real goal here. And you can see that if we can begin a dialogue between our communities from different parts of the world and point the finger at the real criminals, we have an opportunity here to stop them. Now, it's a long shot. There's nothing guaranteed in our success except trying. We have to try. I'm hoping other callers will be calling in so we have other questions. But Andrew, let's go on to another issue here where we're, you know, Albert Pike, of course, working through Freemasonry. You want to talk a little bit about the origins of Freemasonry and who really controls it?
Well, Freemasonry was infiltrated in 1776 by a crypto Jew, and he was working under the instructions of Rothschild, and basically his job was to infiltrate the Masonic lodges first, because the Masonic lodges had the so-called people in them, and then use money and sex bribery and what have you to essentially get the control of these people. The guy's name was Adam Weishaupt, and he was actually organising the Illuminati, and it was going through Freemasonry. And the point of it was to infiltrate by the Masons. You get into governments, you get into top financial areas. They then wanted to get into the faculties of colleges and universities to cultivate students possessing exceptional mental ability, as well as belonging to well-bred families, convince them that internationalism is the way forward. Also, in this, going right back then, was to obtain absolute control of the press. At that time, the only mass communications media was newspapers. And so the idea, again, was to make news slanted towards their aims, which was that internationalism and globalism was the only future for mankind. Because the fact is that you're not going to get a leader that's going to appeal to all communities, all faiths. And so you have to break down the communities, you have to break down the divisions between communities, between faiths, between individuality. And so you mould people into, you know, one you know, people are just clones of one another. There's no individuality. And then they can get control of a lot of them. And I personally think the Third World War idea, we only need to cast our mind back. If you go back to the 70s when we were getting all these plane hijackings, again, blamed on Islam, these groups here. And so I think they're very far behind the times. The book 1984, I mean, that was a year that, you know, George Orwell, real name Eric Blair, thought that this was going to come about. And I think that they're very far behind the times and they thought that they'd have it ready. But they're moving it forward now. And you just look at the United States, for example. They've got a Muslim president now, so-called. He's not a Muslim at all.
But you know darn well that he's not. You know he's a Zionist punk because everybody in his entourage is Jewish Zionist.
Well, he talks a good talk about Guantanamo Bay, for example, but he's not done anything or stopped people there. He's got camps in other areas of the world where Muslims are being detained without charge and subjected to torture and goodness knows what else. And this guy's supposed to be a Muslim. Maybe a listener can call in and... No,
well, no, he doesn't claim to be a Muslim. He actually claims to be a Christian, But his father was supposedly from Islam. However, that whole story of this man's true beginnings is very unclear. We don't even know if he was born in the United States or in Kenya or in Indonesia. We don't know for sure if any of the things they claimed about him are even accurate. But the fact is we do know that everybody around him is coming from the Zionist community. Everyone. Except him and his wife. They're the front people. And so, you know, he's supposed to be the man of the people, but in fact he's the man of the Zionist community.